Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On a fall evening in Corvallis, Oregon, in 1967, 17-year-old Dick Kitchell, a senior at the high school, disappeared after attending a party. 10 days later, his body was spotted by two children as it floated down the Willamette River. He had been beaten and strangled. The investigation into his murder played out during one of the most dramatic years in America. Life in Corvallis, a college town, had offered a protective, idyllic life to many. But in 1967, 1968, Vietnam, a presidential campaign, the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy, and the murder of Dick Kitchell changed all that. His friends thought his death was ignored because Dick was from the wrong side of the tracks. Police and the district attorney thought they knew who had murdered the boy, but never made an arrest. Decades later, a cold case detective believed he, too, had solved the case. However, once again, justice was elusive. Now, nearly 50 years later, a classmate, New York Times bestselling author Rebecca Morris, returns to her hometown to write about how the murder changed the town and the lives of Dick Kitchell's friends. Rebecca Morris is a New York Times bestselling author, If I Can't Have You, Susan Powell, Her Mysterious Disappearance and the Murder of Her Children, A Killing in Amish Country, Ted and Ann, and other books. The book that we're featuring this evening is A Murder in My Hometown, with my special guest, journalist and author, Rebecca Morris. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Rebecca Morris.
Hi, Dan. Thanks so much for having me, inviting me on.
Thank you very much. Like I mentioned, this is a very, very personal story for you, and let's get right to this. Tell us a little bit about Corvallis, Oregon, to let people know the size and the, you talk about the racial mix in the city, in the small town, I should say. But tell us about the size and where it is and a little bit more about Corvallis, Oregon, to introduce this story.
Well, Corvallis is, Oregon is almost all small towns except for Portland, and it's one of the towns in the Willamette Valley that, you know, the pioneers came on the Oregon Trail and settled along the Willamette River and in Oregon because of the what would be rich farmland. It's been a college town since I think the 1870s, and growing from what was basically an agricultural college into Oregon State University. Our rival school is University of Oregon, which is in Eugene, just 40 miles south. So the two main universities are pretty close geographically. But Corvallis, one of the things I learned during this book, Dan, is that I had no idea. You know, when we're in grade school, we're taught Oregon history. Right. But I had no idea that there were slaves that came on the wagon trains to Oregon, and that, as a couple of historians describe it, Oregon's always had a schizophrenic relationship with race. And, in fact, Southerners were most of the group that came west, and what they wanted to do was create another southern state with slavery and other southern ways of life. And so that when Oregon gained statehood in 1859, there was a law that slavery was outlawed, but African Americans couldn't live in the state. And it's remained, Portland even now is considered the whitest city in the country. And there was one you know, one black student in my high school class, and I think it's one of the contributors to the kind of elitism and the town and gown feel of the college, which became an issue in this murder investigation because, you know, we were all white, but there was a class difference that really kicked in.
You talk about October, you write about October 21st, 1967. Specifically, there was a couple, Dan Eccles, a young guy, 13 and 14-year-old friend, Jim Crawford. We talked about the Willamette River.
Yeah.
And they spotted a body. So tell us what they were doing and what they spotted.
Yeah.
And then the police response. Reintroduced Sergeant Montgomery.
Well, Dan Eccles was 13 or 14, as you said, and he and his cousin were fishing off the dock. Dan's father had been a deputy sheriff in Los Angeles, and had moved the family up to Oregon and bought this marina. So the boys were fishing. In those days, the Willamette River was one of the most polluted in America. It's also, I think, one of just two rivers that actually run uphill. It runs south to north. So anyway, they cleaned up the river later, but in 1967, you know, it was really filthy. And therefore, the fish that the boys caught, the one time they tried eating, you know, frying it up and eating, made the family sick. So they just fished for fun. So Dan was, you know, fishing off the dock, and here came this body floating. And he started to reach for it. It was face down. And he had this kind of irrational fear that, well, what if the arm came off if he grabbed it? So he let it float by, but he ran for his father, who, of course, knew how to contact the sheriff's office and the city police. And they brought the body ashore, and it was the body of Dick Kitchell, a 17-year-old high school student who'd been missing for 10 days.
Now, autopsies were done right away, basically, and another captain, if I get this pronunciation wrong, Hakima, and also right away, the district attorney, Frank Knight, there's a coroner, Dr. Rosendahl, are involved. What, you say the autopsies were conducted at the funeral homes, what did they find in those autopsies immediately?
Yeah, in those days, I thought that was really interesting that autopsies were, and, you know, later bodies became, you know, they were sent to Portland, but it was what they found, and Dick's father and stepmother came in and identified him and then left. But he was a little guy, and he was just 5'2" and 125 pounds, and you know, I've never unearthed any information that he was bullied or teased or anything, but he was actually well liked across the different cliques that had formed in high school. But he had been beaten up pretty badly. Both his eyes were bruised, his hands were bruised. You know, there were defensive bruising on his body, and he'd been strangled, and they concluded that he'd been strangled not so much with hands as with an arm or a piece of cloth, and then he'd been put into the river, probably in the spot off the main road in Corvallis. Off the main road means only a block or two, but where two rivers meet, the Marys River and the Willamette River. And then I don't think he'd surfaced for a few days, but eventually he'd surfaced and floated probably just about a mile from where he was put in the river to the marina. So he'd put up a struggle. And, he'd been at a party that night at a home of some older, you know, kids in the early 20s who sort of provided a place and alcohol for teenagers that wanted to go there, and the teenagers would chip in a little bit for, you know, beer or liquor. But he'd been in a scuffle that night. He was known the last couple years of his life for getting into fights. He especially he had, you know, brutal fist fights with his father. And in fact, the very first police officer who arrived at the scene at the river when they were bringing the body ashore had been an officer who'd been called to the Kitchell home more than once to break up fights between Dick and his father.
Now, you talk about his father, Ralph, and his stepmother, Sylvia. His real mother's name's Joan. But at this time, you say that he was discovered on October 21st, 1967. However, when was he reported missing and by who? Tell us about this.
Okay. Well, the party he had been at was 10 days before, basically the night of October 10th and early the morning of October 11th. And he was missing for 5 or 6 days before his father and stepmother went to the police. And this is just one of many things that I found really shocking and actually quite different than probably how something would be done today. But they waited and kind of shrugged off his disappearance and thought maybe he'd gone to the coast with friends. And, you know, sometimes they'd go, he and friends would disappear for a few days. But finally, when he didn't show up on a school day, on a Monday, then they went to the police.
Now, once police speak with Ralph and Sylvia, they compile a list through the parents, a list of Dick's friends, and then they do find out about this party and more about the behavior of Dick and his reputation and how this might have happened. So before we talk about Montgomery, Detectives Montgomery and Hakimima going into this party and speaking to the people that hosted that party, let's talk a little bit about who Dick was. You mentioned the rocky relationship he had with his father, but tell us a little bit more about Dick and this idea that he had friends on the other side of the tracks. You said he was well-liked. Tell us a little bit more about Dick and his life with Ralph and Sylvia.
Yes, well, I knew Dick a little bit. We went to the same junior high school. In those days, it was junior high school. And he signed two of my yearbooks, and there's at least one photograph in one of the yearbooks that shows he's in my social studies class. And he did sign my yearbook, and I write that, you know, I don't know if it's because of his very chaotic childhood or in spite of it, but he was the only boy one of the only boys in junior high school to show up for picture day, you know, in a shirt and tie. And he'd been a sweet kid. I interviewed a lot of his, you know, close friends for the book, and they still call him, you know, 50 years after he's been murdered, they still call him Dickie, which was his childhood name. And his closest friends he made in grade school from he went to Harding School, and he also went to a couple other grade schools in Corvallis. But they were on, summer baseball teams, and he was on one called the Crocodiles. And, you know, the way they spent their days outside of school was, you know, riding bicycles and playing baseball. And the main issue for Dick in his life was that his parents had divorced. His mother had moved back to Washington State, where she was from. On occasion, he would live in Washington State with her, and then would be sent back to Corvallis. And when Dick, by our senior year, his second stepmother was living with him, so that was his father's third marriage. And his father was a small business owner. He owned a shoe repair shop in Corvallis, and they did live south of town where, you know, geography is kind of important in Corvallis. It says a lot about what kind of social class you fall into, and south of town is, you know, just less fancy and simpler. Right. And smaller, you know, modest homes, and no shame in that. But and his parents, he was an only child, but he had, you know, a couple of stepbrothers that sometimes lived with Ralph and Sylvia and him, and sometimes they didn't. And Dick was, he just became kind of, you know, lost when he reached his teenage years. And, you know, because there wasn't, well, there was summer baseball, but he had friends who, you know, would take up snow skiing in the winter. Well, Dick couldn't afford anything like that. And he began to drink. His parents were drinkers and spent a lot of time, you know, bowling or at the Moose Club or the Elks Club in Corvallis, and that was kind of their social life. And Dick had a car that meant the world to him, this baby blue Ford, and he had a jacket, and those were the most important things, a kind of suede, you know, jacket, and those were his two belongings that were so important to him. And on Labor Day weekend, 1967, so just before the party he went to on the last night of his life, he cracked up his car and been arrested for drunk driving and resisting arrest. And, you know, it was kind of a rather spectacular accident, kind of right in the middle of town. And one of his girlfriends was with him in the car. And so his first mention in the local newspaper was as this miner who'd been in the spectacular car wreck. And because he was a miner, his name wasn't mentioned. But, of course, a few weeks later, he'd be murdered. And then, you know, his life was kind of a fair game. And one of the things I think is so interesting is how our hometown newspaper, you know, wrote about this or didn't write about this. I think the town was embarrassed by the murder.
Mm-hmm. You write about that to explain to our audience that you say he's a very small guy, 5 foot two, 125 pounds, but despite that, I guess his family life, and again, you say he turned different when he was a teen, became much more angry. You write about that fighting was not foreign to him whatsoever. Maybe explain that.
Yeah. Well, I now I know, and I think I knew at the time how naive I was. I mean, when I was researching the case and found out that these parties and even the night Dick disappeared was a school night, you know, school nights. Right. You know, I know where I was. I was at home, and he was gone a lot because he wanted to get out of the house, and that's what he and his friends had in common. Some of his friends is they wanted to get out of the house and they wanted to get out of Corvallis. And but Dick was really he had friends in all areas of life. It began to split a bit more in his teenage years in high school, as you know, as some of the kids he grew up with in grade school became, you know, more serious students, and, you know, they were trying to get into good colleges, and they were in, and we were in, you know, college placement, advanced placement classes, and Dick, who, you know, was just an average or a little bit below average student, was taking, you know, shop and car mechanics and things like that. So his friends were, I think, more aware. They stayed friends with him, but they were busy with different things. They had less in common in their teenage years than they'd had in common when they were young. And I think Dick was lonely. He certainly there was alcohol around the house, but he became known as you know, as a partier, and there were a number of places in town where it was, you know, you'd go to be seen. One of them was Seton's Drive-In, which didn't have indoor seating. It was you stayed in your car to eat, and so kids moved between the cars a lot to talk and socialize, and he was called the mayor of Seton's because You know, he was there all the time and had this huge network of people. But he'd begun to fight a lot. And one of the other things I was naive about is that at least, and maybe this is true, I've never been a teenage boy, but in his, you know, his group, there were these fights, and he would try to pick a fight with somebody, or he'd try to have a friend of his fight this kid for him. And I don't know how often there actually were fights, but he talked about it a lot, and all through the police report, when the two detectives interviewed Dick's friends, it's a theme that keeps coming up, that Dick asked so-and-so if they would fight so-and-so for him. And I myself didn't really know that was one of the things that occupied at least, you know, some teenage boys' days and nights, was thinking about fights. But I assume there's some psychological connection to his relationship with his father in all of that, is that, you know, he was angry, and he was, the night he showed up for that party, he was, looking forward to some kind of altercation. He was also drunk, and there was an argument at the party, I always thought, well, that must have led to his disappearance, but it was actually something quite different.
Let's talk about, you talk about Detective Montgomery and Hakama, and Assistant Chief Hakamima. Assistant.
Yeah.
And Chief Burright, and they went to Paul and Judy Everett's home.
Yes.
Now, who were there? And it's really interesting what they were doing when the detectives and the chief went there. What were they doing? Who were they were on the list given by Ralph and Sylvia to the detectives. So who was on that list that was at this home the day after this event apparently happened?
Well, I think you're talking about after the day his body is found, which is 10 days after he disappeared, the day the body's brought out of the river. Late that night, the DA and the assistant police chief and the two detectives go to the home where they know Dick had been to this party the last night of his life. And what they find is pretty much the makeup of the people who'd been there the same night as Dick's last night. There's Paul and Judy Everts, who are the renters of the house and who are also, you know, from our high school, but are a little bit older, 22, 23 years old. There are a couple of other 17-year-old boys, and Mel Plemons and Marty Tucker, and there is this 23-year-old, Doug Hamblin, who is kind of has a reputation around town as a troublemaker, and they turns out to be the exact makeup of the people who'd been there the night Dick was there, and they were playing the same game that they'd played 10 days before, which is called, pass out? Just drink until you pass out. And now on the night that Dick was there, on the 10th, there had been, you know, probably a dozen other teenage kids come in and out, you know, buy some alcohol and leave. On this night, 10 days later, it's just the key, you know, the key five people. And they're playing the same drinking game. But the thing I thought was really interesting is, you know, the detectives tell them, you know, your friend Dick, who you're the last people to see him alive probably, you know, he was found dead today, murdered. And nobody flinched. And maybe they'd already heard it because it was 12 hours after the body had been found and word kind of travels fast, Corvallis or a small town, but, or maybe they had firsthand knowledge and weren't surprised, but nobody seemed very surprised. And their names were on the list that, or some of their names were on the list that Dick's parents came up with, but there were also other, a lot of other names on the list, including the two girls, you know, he'd been dating, and, you know, some boyhood friends, and a boy in Dick's neighborhood who, you know, because Dick didn't have his car, because he'd smashed it up, he needed a ride to the party October 10th, and a neighbor boy had given him a ride, and so they had a long list of people to talk to, but I think they knew very early on that there was something about the people at that party house.
Now, how did they find out about exactly about the car ride and the drop-off? And at the same time, you write that they're hearing rumors as well at the same time as they begin their investigation. Who gives them information that sort of directs them towards Doug?
Yes. Well, people they had, you know, they had began talking to people as soon as, you know, they found Dick's body. And they knew, I believe they knew before they got to the house on the 21st, that Doug Hamblin had given Dick a ride. And, you know, and he had to admit that because everybody knew it. And for 10 days, among Dick's group, you know, they didn't know he'd been murdered. They didn't know what had happened to him. But they knew that Doug Hamblin had given him a ride after the party. Everybody knew that. Doug had taken three boys home who needed rides at midnight on that night. And two of them were, like, north of the city. And Dick was the last person in Doug's car. And so people knew that Doug had given Dick a ride, so what he told the police is that Dick wouldn't tell him where he lived, and so Doug said he just dropped him off on a downtown street that was, you know, incidentally, you know, a block and a half from the river. And so they knew fairly early on that Doug Hamblin, who was 23, was probably the last person to see Dick. The rumors that were circulating early on were about, you know, gangs. I mean, we're not talking, you know, inner city gangs, but groups of kids from maybe, you know, the smaller towns east of Corvallis or south of Corvallis had come, you know, cruising through town and seen him or picked him up or something, or that something went wrong like that. The theory that, in fact, my classmates for 50 years, I mean, we assumed his father had killed him, that Dick had gotten home, he'd had one last fight with his father, and his father had maybe even accidentally killed him, and then he'd gotten rid of his body. I thought that until last year. We never had any idea that the focus was on Doug Hamblin. It wasn't made public at the time. It was made public that he was among Dick's friends who had polygraphs. The DA never told, so it wasn't, of course, in the Gazette Times that Doug had failed three polygraphs, but now we know he did. And so really for 50 years we thought, you know, his father had killed him, and maybe in an accident. So he was somebody that the police needed to eliminate. And, you know, Dick's father and stepmother balked at taking polygraphs, but they finally did. And so they began to, you know, they gave polygraphs to a lot of the teenagers and began to kind of winnow the list of suspects.
Some suspects, when asked for a lie detector test, act, at least according to the police, in a suspicious manner. When he was asked for a lie detector test, what was his response?
Dick's father? Well,
no, Doug.
Doug.
No, Doug.
Well, Doug agreed. And it's interesting. He, you know, they told them that night that they showed up at the house that they wanted to do polygraphs, and he agreed. And within 2 days, the detectives were driving them to Eugene, where the police or sheriff's office had a polygraph examiner. And even from after the first test, the examiner said that Doug's test was inconclusive. The newspaper story, the next newspaper story about the case after the first big story that Dick had been found murdered, was about the detectives taking this group of kids to have polygraphs, and it named them, even the 17-year-olds, and it named Doug. But it did. It just said, you know, the headline was they seemed to pass. So the DA knew there was problems with Doug's polygraph, but they weren't going to, you know, admit it in the newspaper at that point. And they never did. They just wanted to, you know, they were going to put some pressure on him. And so he consented to a second polygraph. And then finally they did a third one at the state police headquarters in Salem, and that's when the examiner said, you know, most likely this is your killer.
You talk about the difference in...
At that point, so Doug had finally hired an attorney, and the attorney said, you know, you either charge him or you back off, and they couldn't, they didn't think they had enough to charge him.
You talk about the difference in forensics and police procedure back then in the 70s, way back then, or late 60s even. Late 60s. And so you talk about how the police handled this case in terms of the difference on where the crime scene was, or the supposed crime scene, or what was determined as a crime scene on 4th and B Street, where supposedly he dropped them off. Considering there was 10 days later for things to happen like nature and rain and things like that, but also that there was other things like a code in the car. So tell us about this code in the car, and then the idea of, again, normally what they would do with processing a car that would be, that they would want to search and process. Tell us about what the police did at that time, and again, what they would have done today.
Yes, or even what they might have done then and didn't do.
Right.
So the first thing Dick's father, you know, while he's identifying the body, he says, "Where's Dick's coat?" Because Dick was in his, you know, cowboy boots and jeans and a T-shirt, and you know the police at the funeral homes say, well, we didn't see a coat. There is no coat. So word spread really quickly, you know, where was Dick's coat? And so when the police visit the Everett's home 10 days later, they ask, you know, what about Dick's coat? And Doug Hamblin actually, you know, volunteers, and I just think he did because it would have been worse if he'd caught lying. He said he found a coat in his car that week, and he thought it was a child's coat, and so he'd given it to a 9-year-old neighbor boy. And he got it back from, you know, the police didn't go get it, which you'd think they would do. They the next time they saw Doug had brought it to them. So, one of my theories is that when Dick realized he was going to be fighting with Doug, that he took off his coat and put it in the car because that was, you know, a cherished belonging to him. Of course, 1967, 68, it's before DNA testing. It's before an awful lot of things could be done that are done now routinely. I was surprised that they didn't seize Doug's car once they knew he was a suspect. They went and looked at it, walked around it, looked inside, didn't see anything. I know today the car would be seized and there'd be some kind of more detail examination of it. The night that they showed up at the Everett's house, 10 days after the murder, they looked at Doug's hands. But he worked at a metal foundry, and, you know, his hands were greasy, dirty, well-worn anyway. They didn't see anything. He didn't appear to have been, you know, hit in the face, and they just couldn't tell by really looking at him 10 days later. But what really stymied them is that they didn't have a crime scene. I mean, we don't really know if he let Dick off at 4th and B Streets downtown. They went and looked around there. It'd be a quiet area at night. There's kind of a main street through there, but not a lot of traffic at night. The state employment office is on one corner. There's some apartment buildings, a couple other small businesses. You're right, 10 days had passed and probably it rained, but they didn't find anything there. So they don't know where the crime was committed. They had no, you know, forensics. They had no confession. They just really didn't have much to go on besides the polygraphs, which, of course, are inadmissible in court. In a murder, evidence is supposed to be kept indefinitely, and there were some things, and I'm not sure, maybe I should wait to go into that, but when a cold case detective looked at this, you know, 40 years later, there were a lot of things lost or missing, and that happens when decades pass, but it would have been nice if things had been kind of better organized, I guess.
Now, you have the two detectives, the central figures in this, Jim Montgomery and Dick Huckema.
Bill Huckema and Jim Montgomery, yeah.
Yeah, right. And they have to not focus on Doug necessarily. They've got to, and then they come to the realization that there's more to Doug as a suspect, and that hence the inconclusive polygraph, and then up to the third one where they get a conclusive, at least from the examiner, response to say this guy is likely responsible for the murder. But these two detectives have to go through every other lead and talk to everybody involved, not only at that party, but ex-wives and the babysitter, Pat Hockett. So how do they proceed with this? And how it's interesting how much they relied on in those days, this inadmissible polygraph test, to be able to go further with this. So given that they rely on those polygraph tests, once everybody has been given the go-ahead and cleared, how do they proceed with, and who do they look at as potential other suspects in this?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was a reporter for, you know, many years, and then I've been writing true crime books for just 8 or 10 years, but I continue to learn how important it is that police don't have tunnel vision and focus on the one suspect. It turns out, I mean, that's really important, because if they miss their opportunity with other people and with other, you know, paths of the investigation, it may be too late to go back. So they were, you know, pretty open-minded about it. And I should explain, it was a pretty short investigation. By early 1968, so the murder was in October, this had a pretty short life, because there was nowhere much for them to go with it. And once you've talked to, you know, the 30 or 40 people who knew these people, there were no leads. And I think the thing that that Doug Hamblin was lucky about was that, you know, nobody drove along, nobody saw anything. You know, they were trying to find witnesses or look at different scenarios. Had Dick been hitchhiking and picked up, or, you know, was he seen after leaving Doug's car? And he never was. And then in 1968, you know, the detectives were pulled off onto other cases. Just to back up for a second, the other thing about the investigation procedures at the time, that of course it's, you know, pre-cell phones, and the fact that today, you know, people have, we leave an electronic footprint. You know, there's nothing
right.
we do that can't be traced. And it just was so interesting to remember that in 1967, 68, that was not the case. Or what a detective I talked to recently about another case called Life Patterns. You, and maybe everybody knows that term, but I didn't know it as far as a police investigation, that you look at somebody's life patterns. And in this case, they would have looked at Dick's, and they would have looked at Doug Hamblin's and the other parties involved to see, well, what did they do differently? Were they ever seen after this moment in time? You know, when was the next moment in time? What would they... You know, what would Doug usually be doing the next day, and could they look to see if he, you know, showed up at work, for instance, and if he changed his life patterns? So they proceeded by really talking to everybody. The girl who was the live-in babysitter for Paul and Judy Everts, who hadn't been there the night of the party, or she'd been there and then left for a while. They went to California to find her, and you know, there were some people that the rumor was they moved away very quickly, and you know, it just seemed to be kind of coincidence, but they checked all that out. But really they were left with their main suspects were here's the fellow who flunks three polygraphs, and then there's Dick's father, who was, you know, very surly to the police. The other thing I found most shocking is that never once did Dick's father call or show up at the police department and nag them and say, what's going on with the investigation in my son's murder? Never once. Now, they dropped in on him at the shoe store, and he and Sylvia didn't like that much. And, you know, thank goodness Jim Montgomery took all these detailed notes for the police file, because there's absolutely perfect lines of dialogue of them saying, we know our rights, you know, we know our rights. You can't hound us like this. And they were not very sympathetic parents or people in this case. And it appears, you know, Dick's father didn't kill him, but it was it's hard to find sympathy for them.
You write about them visiting Martha Taylor. So the detectives talk to Martha Taylor, and they ask, and she says why he left, but also that he was attending church. Now, why is this important, and what do the detectives... Well, what do they conclude or determine from this bit of information?
Yeah. Well, Martha Taylor was the third of Doug Hamblin's wives. And she, you know, has been very open about things with me. She married Doug when in the 1970s, and she had two daughters from another marriage. And so... This is the later the cold case detective in 2008 goes to talk to her, and I don't. Well, they didn't. Of course, she wasn't on the scene. I mean, she didn't know Doug in the 60s, so she didn't know about then. But she told them that, and they had heard at the time that Doug Hamblin was suddenly attending a church in Corvallis after the murder, and appeared to be possibly confiding in a minister at the church, and that minister accompanied Doug to the third polygraph exam in Salem. And at some point, the detectives went to see the minister, and the minister told them, if you're looking at Doug Hamblin, you're looking in the right direction. So that was a pretty big thing to hear from somebody that Doug was confiding in. And so, you know, it's a little sticky with what kind of, it's kind of like, you know, privacy rights around clients of attorneys. You know, what can an attorney share and what can a minister share? But the minister shared that with the detectives in 1967 or 1968. So Martha knew that Doug had, you know, basically what she knew as his third wife was that this incident had happened and Doug said, you know, he didn't do it. She went to an attorney 1 year to deal with a custody issue from her former marriage. And the attorney said, oh, you're married to Doug Hamblin, the only man to get away with murder in Corvallis. And so she thinks he was very much capable of it. You know, he was a brute. He drank a lot. He got angry. And he had problems with rage. And he never admitted it to her. But she thought he was, you know, capable of it.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop just for a second to talk about our sponsor, Blue Apron. Skip meal planning and get straight to cooking with Blue Apron. Enjoy delicious meals that are great on the grill, like honey chipotle glazed chicken with poblano and lime rice. Add smoky depth to your dinner while enjoying the warm weather and getting those perfect grill marks. With incredible ingredients and chef-designed recipes, Blue Apron lets you see the power of what food can do. Blue Apron delivers fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes right to your door that can be cooked in under 45 minutes. The menu changes every week based on what is in season and is designed by Blue Apron's in-house culinary team. Blue Apron sends only non-GMO ingredients and meat with no added hormones. Blue Apron offers 12 new recipes each week, and customers can pick 2, 3, or 4 recipes based on what best fits their schedule. I tried the chipotle glazed chicken with poblano, and poblano is just a mild chili pepper, and mixed it with the rice, the lime rice. And my wife and I made this, put it together ourselves. It was fantastic tasting, and we made it ourselves at home. The chipotle glazed chicken was fantastic, and the mix of spices, the poblano, was delicious. Check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free at blueapron.com/murder. That's blueapron.com/murder to get your first 3 meals free. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Now, Rebecca, we were talking about all of the information that Detective Montgomery had and his partner, Hakama, and but they went to the DA, Frank Knight, and what was his response to all the evidence gathering that they had and their idea that they should take this to the grand jury? What did Frank Knight continually have to say to these two detectives regarding the chances of doing that?
Well, he said then, and he says today, that they're just, you know, there wasn't any conclusive evidence. And, of course, he was afraid that if they tried Doug on manslaughter or murder charges and he was acquitted, that was it. That was their one shot, and because you can't be retried. And he was, you know, they tried putting some pressure on Doug, not in a physical kind of way, but, you know, they would meet with him alone and hope to kind of intimidate him, and the detectives, you know, went home every night just really frustrated. One of the themes that came through when I began talking to my classmates about this murder was there was an overwhelming sense that if Dick's father had been prominent in the town, that this would have been solved. that somebody would have been arrested and convicted. And when I began to look into this 3 years ago, I mean, I was really stunned at how widespread that feeling was, that this was actually about class in our college town and kind of the haves and have-nots. And I asked, you know, that there wouldn't have been a book without these two detectives and the DA, who are all now, you know, in their 80s and still, you know, have very sharp memories. And I asked them about that, that, you know, would it have made a difference if Dick's father was, you know, a university person like my dad was. And they said, you know, of course they said, no, not at all. They were, you know, in a lot of agony over not being able to bring, they'd never had a case they hadn't closed. They'd never had a murder they hadn't closed. And so they, you know, took this personally. They were all, every one of them had young children themselves. And, it really became personal for them to try to close this and try to find some justice for Dick. And, the DA just said there wasn't enough there. A cold case detective later on that I'm sure we'll talk about had a different opinion. But, it's not enough to be the person who gave somebody a ride on the last night of their life. They didn't know who had killed him.
Mm-hmm. You talk about in 2008 that enters into this story is the detective Tyson Poole, Corvallis Police Department. He inherited a cold case, and that was a 1967 murder of Dick Kitchell. He was assigned. Take a look. This is the first in four. It's 40 years later. So,
yes.
How did he approach this differently? And then, with his different approach, what did he find?
Yeah. Well, of course, he was a young detective. He'd been trained differently than Hakama and Montgomery had been. He had had even specialized forensic training. So he comes to it, of course, and, you know, decades after we know about DNA and everything. So he felt like the case had just kind of been forgotten. And what he did is he was a great believer in organization, and he has a very methodical way of dealing with a cold case, which pays off for him. Usually, and it seems very simple, but just to, you know, begin at the beginning and get everything organized for one thing. Well, what he found is that the original police report and the notes, they'd never been typed up. They'd never been, kept in a formal record keeping of any kind. The audio tapes that had been made with Doug Hamblin when they'd met with him alone, one-on-one, not only were lost, they'd never been transcribed.
Right.
Dick's clothing was missing. Photos that were taken at the river when the body was first discovered had never been developed, and the negatives were missing. Now, that, I found, actually isn't unusual. Usually, photos aren't developed until, you know, the DA or somebody asks for them, but the negatives were missing, the photos had never been developed, the audio tapes were gone, but Tyson Poole continued to think that Doug could have been charged. And so over a couple of years, the cold case detective was pulled off to work on other things. He came back to it. He went to talk with Martha Taylor and also talked with a man who'd been a neighbor of Doug's first wife, and who said that Doug had confessed the murder to his first wife, who is deceased now. Tyson Poole was ready to talk to the DA in 2011 about bringing charges, and Doug Hamblin had just died. And so that was, you know, he was too late.
Yeah.
So the case is considered closed. It's called a closed conditionally. Closed exceptionally is the term, meaning it's closed because prosecutors either declined to proceed or because of the death of the suspect. So in this case, that's probably both of them. One of the things I thought was so interesting, having spent my life in broadcasting my first few decades, is what news coverage was like at the time, that there was never, ever a story in the paper about, you know, who Dick was. And today, you know, we'd see TV cameras at the school, or there'd be stories, you know, quoting Dick's coach, or a teacher, or his shop teacher, or his friends, who played baseball with him. I mean, you know what I mean, Dan. We'd
right.
get a glimpse of who was this young person. And there was nothing like that. And I just don't think, you know, the media worked like that then. So, you know, people reading about it in the paper never really knew who he was or what happened to him. And an incredibly sad thing is that, you know, adults and friends of his parents were overheard saying, you know, good riddance, you know, good riddance. It couldn't happen, you know, to a better kid. And just writing this off because he'd been in some trouble.
Yeah, some minor stuff, really, considering.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he didn't hurt anybody when he drove his car into the mailbox, and it was pretty minor stuff, and there were never any, you know, there was no drugs. There probably was, you know, pot around Corvallis in the late 60s, but I think the DA told me the very first arrest for any drug-related thing in Corvallis was up on the college campus in the early 70s when, you know, a guard at a entrance to the university smelled pot from a car, and that was the very first drug arrest in Corvallis. It was rather tame.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you write that Tyson Poole met with John Lee, the man who had contacted police in the 70s, saying
yes.
he had information about Dick's murder.
Yeah.
And you say that a note with his name was stuck on the back of the original case file. But it was Poole that met with him, and like, as you mentioned, he had said that he lived across the street from Doug's first wife, Teresa, and he said that Teresa told him many times that Doug had committed murder, and he had tried to convince him or her to go to authorities, but you said she was afraid. So
yes. Well, she'd been married to Doug twice. They had divorced and then remarried. They had a small child, and Doug's mother actually was married 8 times to 6 men. So that kind of ran in the family. But Teresa was afraid to go to the police, and I think, you know, and Doug also has a brother who wouldn't communicate with me for the book, which is absolutely his right.
Sure.
I think they might be the only people who, you know, whoever knew exactly what had happened. But, you know, the police did conclude that it probably was an accident. It probably would have been a manslaughter charge, that Doug and Dick got into a fight. They'd probably argued in the car before, you know, he pulled over somewhere. I don't think he ever stopped at 4th and B Street. I think he went over where it was dark near the river, and the passenger side door of Doug's car was broken so that you had to slide across, you know, the bench seat to leave the car. And he told police he had to drag Dick out of the car. And I think he dragged Dick out, and they began to fight. Dick stopped to take off his jacket, And then, you know, Dick was beaten and strangled, maybe with Doug's arm. And I think, you know, Doug panicked and took Dick's body to a place with hidden access to the river nearby. And he'd been in trouble, you know, a lot of his life, and Doug Hamblin went ahead and, as an adult, was in some trouble off and on. And, you know, if he kept it to himself for all those years, I can't imagine it was, you know, pleasant.
I don't want to disagree with you, but what I found weird, and you didn't address it, was the story that Dick wouldn't tell him where he lived in this small town. And to me, it seems there is no good reason why Dick would be that belligerent,
no,
regardless, to say, someone's giving you a ride, but you're not going to tell him where you live. So I thought that this idea of the accidental death, certainly I don't think he planned the murder. There's no evidence of, or even, I can't see an inkling of why he would do that.
Yeah.
But you do state a pretty good case that he had a violent propensity, and that certainly Dick was considered sort of a pain in the ass, and that it acted up at this party as well, and been disrespectful to the hosts.
I actually agree with you on all of that. And in fact, Doug was not the person Dick had the confrontation with at the party.
No.
You know, he'd had a confrontation with Paul Everts, the host, and various kids at the party had various, you know, recollections of this, but Doug wasn't that person at all. And Doug, you know, Doug had his own problems, and I don't think he intended to hurt or fight Dick at all, but he found himself with that. Yeah, Dick was being a pain in the ass, and so Doug, you know, pulled over somewhere to let him out of the car. I suppose he dreamt up the, you know, he wouldn't tell me where he lived because he couldn't think of another reason that he'd pulled over his car and Dick had gotten out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody knew Dick had been, you know, the last person to be dropped off in the car. And why didn't Dick get home? Well, because something had prompted Doug to pull over the car. But,
and
you know, they were, you know, both pretty unhappy people, and then they'd been drinking, and I think it just got out of hand.
But what do you think about, regardless of whether these people passed their lie detector tests, and what was interesting, you write that Judy, which was there at that day, was not considered a suspect at all, not whatsoever, was not given the lie detector test, even though her husband was, and other people were. And then the reaction that you have, which I think is just very, very striking, that when they came again 10 days after they discovered the body, that these people were playing a drinking game, which seems to be convenient. Again, if you really wanted to kind of bolster your nerves or get up the nerve to be able to answer questions, and yet how on earth could those people not know if the town believed at some point that Doug was the guy? Why wouldn't those people at that party, given all the circumstances, believe Doug had done it as well?
Well, I think they probably did. Now, Judy Everts has passed away. I did talk to Paul a couple of times, and he, you know, didn't seem to remember a lot of details, and you know, my way is not to hound somebody, but he people, and I suppose if he's reading the book, he knows this now, that people at the party describe what happened at the party differently than he did to me. You know, he
right.
says Dick got into a scuffle with somebody. Well, numerous people at the party told police that Dick had gotten into a scuffle with Paul because Dick
right.
had said something rude to Judy, and Paul took him outside and grabbed him by the neck and put him up against the pillar and gave him a talking to. You know, that's what numerous people at the party say happened. So I thought myself that, well, maybe Paul Everts was, you know, going to be a suspect. But he wasn't. But the other thing that, as far as I know, the 10 days later when the detective showed up at the house and found the same small group of people, they never asked Doug, as far as I know, well, why did it take you 90 minutes to drive, I don't know, 4 miles, drop off these kids, and come back? Doug had returned. I don't think I said that yet. Doug had returned to the house the night of the murder.
Yeah.
And I'm just so curious. Well, did he stop at his place, which was an apartment downtown, and clean himself up? Did he need to do that? Or when he got back to Paul and Judy's, this is within, you know, minutes of the murder. Did he ask for a Band-Aid? Did he wash himself and, you know, clean up in their bathroom? Or mm-hmm. and they were never asked, well, what was Doug's, you know, demeanor when he returned to the party on October 10th, 11th? And why would it take him 90 minutes, really, to drive 3 kids a couple of miles? And there's no indication that they looked into, you know, what was happening. Well, I guess it was part of that missing time was when he was fighting Dick and deciding what to do with the body.
One of the most fascinating optimistic things in this, as we're reading it, as a mystery unfolds in this, are they going to be able to get Doug for this murder, is that in 2008, when Tyson Poole came on the scene, he went and got advice as to whether that minister could be, that they could question that minister after all those years.
Yeah. And he did. He talked to the DA about, could we compel the minister to say what he'd been told. And the DA in 2008 said yes. Now, mm-hmm. that wasn't the case in 1967-68. I don't know that they considered, could they compel the minister to reveal that. I mean, they knew it. He told the detectives, and the detectives, you know, had told the DA, but I'm not aware that they, you know, had a conversation about is that evidence to take to the grand jury. But in 2008, the DA thought they could.
It's interesting because he had voluntarily made that statement, which would allude
yeah.
to. So with that alone, I think they would have made at least some progress with him in terms of saying you're going to have to admit to at least this statement. If he
right.
said no, I'm going to stick with the confidentiality.
We know you've confessed to somebody, and I'm not aware that they ever went back to Doug and said, you know, I don't think they ever said your minister has ratted on you, or we know this, or we know that you've confessed to somebody. And if I see them next week when I'm in Corvallis, I will ask them that. I'm not aware that they ever confronted him with that. And I assume the minister wanted it kept private, but...
Sure.
And going back to Judy for a second, I think the reason she wasn't polygraphed is just kind of, you know, a gender conclusions at the time that, she was, they had a baby, they had a year and a half year old child. She was a young woman. She was 21 at the time. And, she rode along with them to Eugene, but was not polygraphed. And I think probably today that she would be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, she got a pass back then.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting because you write that they wanted to ask her questions, so they asked her questions off the record. But again, no record of what she said, and assuming that she had...
Yeah, they would go to her workplace and talk to her, and, that makes sense, because to get away from her husband and the other guys and everything.
Sure.
And she, admitted that she'd had a relationship with Doug, we're not sure how much, her husband knew about that, or if it was in the past, or the distant past, or the not so distant past. But
that would be quite important in terms of a motive. Again, if she were to be polygraphed, and if they were to have an inconclusiveness, if they were to be able to imagine that she could be potentially knew something, and she was disrespected at this party, and Doug drove the person that disrespected her, again, it does show
you've got a good point. You've got a really good point. And especially because, most the people that I've talked to who've, taken polygraph tests. I don't think I've ever talked to an actual examiner. I've read the reports, and these reports, when I found them, were quite thorough as far as what exactly was asked and the way it's asked. And I've talked to people recently who have taken polygraph, and a lot of times it's not, it's not, did you kill Dick Kitchell? It would be, did you see Dick Kitchell after 12 midnight on this date? Or do you know what happened? Or, and maybe they do, to some people, ask more pointed questions. But I've been interested in how kind of roundabout they can be. And I don't know if that's a way of... sort of more subtle testing or more subtle test results. Do you know, Dan? It just seems like a lot of the questions are kind of roundabout. Do you know about, or do you know what happened, or did you see him put in the river? That sort of.
I think it's a way to measure compared to the control. Where innocuous questions or innocent questions are given, and then they up that with questions that will roundabout confirm things without a confrontational question per se. But I don't know. I mean, this book at least sheds quite a bit of light on exactly what kind of questions. So I know that, especially in the last year or so, that so many books that I've covered on the program refer to how much the police relied on those polygraph tests, despite them being inadmissible. They really did use them and rely on them and believe in the results. And as you show in this book, just with a different, with the police saying, we want somebody else to examine. They didn't go with the same examiner. They went with another examiner, and hence that other examiner came up with a different opinion. And as we know from all the cases and documentaries that have come up lately, that sometimes there's a bias going into that room.
Oh, yeah.
And to say, so it's a bias that can't be controlled, and I think that's what I'm hearing in a lot of, in the last year, some of that.
Yeah. And I think as time passed and they gave Doug Hamblin mark polygraph tests that there was probably a bias building. I really hadn't known much about polygraph tests, and I didn't know that, you know, like the detectives would go down early enough that they could talk to the polygraph examiner and go over what questions to ask and suggest questions, and that could evolve over time. And also they'd be checking with, for instance, if Doug Hamlin had told them one thing in an interview, then would he say the same thing during a polygraph exam or not? I mean, it sounds very simple and basic, but I didn't really know that, well, the detectives could suggest questions because, of course, how would this polygraph examiner know, you know, what they were trying to find out? He'd have to be told. And then it was very different questions that they asked, you know, Dick's stepbrother, who, you know, they fought a lot, and Dick actually picked on him, although the stepbrother was a little older. So he was kind of a suspect for a day or two. And the kinds of questions they asked him were quite different, about maybe framing it as if he'd been an observer to the murder, you know, and that might have well been if Dick's father, you know, maybe the stepbrother had been along with it. But it's incidentally when I started looking into this 3 years ago, there was nothing at the police department to be found. There was no case file. There was just nothing. And I knew that in 2008 that the cold case detective had met with Frank Knight, the DA, and the two detectives and a couple other detectives to talk about the case. So that's another thing where the cold case started with, detectives started with, talk to the people who were there. And thank goodness, you know, they were still around. And so I knew that he'd held this case file in his hand, the cold case guy. So when I was, you know, urging the police department, you know, they went through the basement, they went through their boxes, they thought had been lost or tossed. And finally I said, you know, in 2008, Tyson Poole sat at this desk, and then he left, and he's on the force in Bend, Oregon. Would you just look in his desk? Because I knew he'd had it in his hand in 2008. Right. And they looked, and they found it.
Wow. You're a pretty good detective yourself.
Pardon?
Yeah, I said you're a pretty good detective yourself in this case.
Well, you just have to keep, you know, looking. And I don't think police departments are ever happy, ever, about somebody looking, you know, at a closed case, an open case, a cold case. You know, I think it's a, but anyway, we found it, I think it's actually law that, you know, I mean, it is in the public domain if there's a police case. And I've had to pay sometimes hundreds and hundreds of dollars to get a copy, but, you know, and I've had other stories where, you know, it's completely lost. There's another story I'm interested in Oregon, a book, and that just doesn't seem to exist anywhere, including, you know, state archives or anything. It was a really important case in 1961, and the first woman sentenced to death in Oregon. And there are no records at all. So you almost need, there is a trial transcript that we paid $1,000 for.
Sure.
So, because you have to have now, some kind of record.
Mm-hmm. Now, a huge part of this is that this is a murder that occurred in your hometown, hence the title of Murder in My Hometown. And we've skipped over basically what you and your classmates, you mentioned that 525 people graduated in 1968, I believe, and everybody
yes.
was affected differently, but you say everybody in Corvallis, all those students that were there, they were affected. Then tell us, when this happened, again, your interest in true crime and journalism and writing, and how this affected you, and to the point where you became involved in this, and to write this book, and involved in this case, interviewed these people that were involved, these detectives and DA. Tell us, go back, as you do in writing the book, tell us how
okay.
it started.
Well, just over 3 years ago, I put something on our class Facebook page, our high school class Facebook page, that, and I wish I could tell you why I'd started thinking about Dick, and maybe because I was between books or something, and I put something on our Facebook page saying, you know, I'm a true crime author, and I've just been thinking about Dick Kitchell's unsolved murder, and I heard from dozens, literally dozens of classmates who said they had never forgotten it, never forgotten that it had never been solved, never forgotten that he'd just been forgotten and that there'd never been an arrest. So I went down 3 years ago, and, of course, I've been back to my hometown many, many times over the years, but I started going down every couple of months, and the first time I met with a group of about a dozen classmates, and just to talk about, you know, their memories of Dick, of the murder, and to talk about, you know, growing up in Corvallis. And then I found that the DA and the two detectives were still around, and I started talking to people. Because you can't do a book like this. But Dick's family, you know, his parents were deceased. Mm-hmm. And a stepbrother and didn't want to speak with me. And so there's no family to talk to. But in fact, Dick's friends were his family. And I was asked the other day why the book is dedicated to our high school class of 1968. It's because that was Dick's family, literally.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first themes that came up in the Facebook posts, and then when I started going down there and meeting with classmates, is that this idea about, you know, if his father had been prominent, that it would have been different. And I'd always wanted to write something about Corvallis, and I will say it's rather frightening to do a memoir, and I do call this, you know, part true crime, part memoir. And I said a lot more personal things than I thought I would in the book, but I think Corvallis became a character in the book, and to write
right.
about Corvallis' character and to write about, you know, its history, and then what I did was follow the lives of several classmates through our senior year, and ones that knew Dick well and ones that didn't know Dick well, but also seemed to represent things that were going on with our generation. And we were a really, you know, isolated town, and there weren't a lot of political demonstrations. There, you know, wasn't really diversity. You know, social class was important. And we were a very, very highly educated group because we had teachers with lots and lots of graduate degrees, and I'm sure it's the school district is always known for, you know, having the best and the brightest. But we also
sure.
had, you know, other kids who didn't do as well. So I try to tell the story of 1968, which is a pretty pivotal year in America, and how, you know, my classmates, we marched when Martin Luther King was assassinated. That, you know, the Oregon presidential primary used to be a lot more important than it is now that Iowa and New Hampshire have kind of taken over. But, you know, Richard Nixon was campaigning in Corvallis. Robert Kennedy was killing in Corvallis. And literally, the word spread. Our graduation evening party was stopped with the announcement that Kennedy had just been shot in Los Angeles. So the bigger world was beginning to come into Corvallis, and along with knowing, you know, Dick's murder went unsolved, you know, that was the year we were growing up.
You also talk about, which very sound might be surprising to some people, but you talk about your interest in true crime as well, and that came to be.
Yeah. And I realized as I was writing this that while my mother grocery shopped, I'd be over in a section of the Safeway reading True Detective magazines at a pretty young age. I was just kind of fascinated with, you know, and especially how the women were portrayed, that, you know, they were always a victim. And I just got interested in it. And then I didn't know I was interested in crime or true crime. For the many years I worked in radio and TV news in New York City and in Seattle and in Portland, Oregon, and also was writing for magazines and newspapers. And then my very first book about a girl missing from Tacoma, Washington since 1961, and her neighbor, Ted Bundy, as a teenager, grew out of an article for the Seattle Times that I was writing for. There had never been a book about that case, and I got to know the girl's mother and basically spent the last year of this woman's life with her, interviewing her, and found whoever else was still around that had known Doug, I'm sorry, known Ted Bundy and known him as a young person. So that was my first book, and then the opportunities kind of, you know, the door opened to writing more about true crime. And I couldn't have told you I was going to end up doing this, but it's pretty interesting. And I think back to when I was reading, you know, True Detective as a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always say, this is not original with me, but the crime is the end of the story. I mean, I'm really interested in what leads up to it and who the people are, you know, both the perpetrators and the victims and the community in which a crime takes place. It's always, you know, sort of my favorite part of painting the story of a crime.
It's very interesting how you portray the event, October 11th, 1967, and then the response in school over the public, the PA system that was announced that Dick had been, you know, was missing, and then later how the information came out, and how the kids talked among themselves, but the parents didn't talk to the kids. Unlike today, there would have been, like you say, trauma counselors. There would have been more discussion at what this meant to the students, and yet the students talked among themselves.
And I think it's a really interesting example of how, you know, how we've changed as a culture. And, you know, as my brother and I always say, you know, we were loved and we had great parents, but we weren't doted on. And that literally was the time when, you know, you could go out and play and disappear for the day and you know, ride your bikes and we just weren't policed, you know, as parents do today. But no, parents didn't talk to their kids. And even the two women I spoke to who were his girlfriends at the time, their parents didn't sit down and talk with them about what this, you know, how they felt about this kid who they dated and murdered. And, you know, one of his friends told me that, you know, he heard somebody say, you know, good riddance and everything, and he just went home to his bedroom and cried. And I think there were his friends who really felt it like that and, you know, and went to the funeral. And then there were his acquaintances or the people he drank with who, you know, they talked more but on a more of a gossip level among themselves about it. But it didn't seem to be something that families talked about then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, including my own. And my parents may not have known that I knew him or just thought I went to school with him, and that's true. But, you know, today we, well, I don't know, you know, helicopter parents and all that, we'd be taking the temperature, wouldn't we, of how this affects our kids.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Rebecca Morris, for coming on and talking about a murder in my hometown. It was a fascinating story, and your incredible personal involvement in this story. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you, Dan.
That might want to take a look at other work of yours, I know this is a Wild Blue Press release, but where might they look? Do you have a web page or Facebook?
I do have a website. It's RebeccaTMorris.com. And very proud of a number of books I've done, including Ted and Ann, which I talked about, and the book about Susan Powell, who's still missing in Utah, and her husband who killed himself and their children. The book is If I Can't Have You. And that was fascinating because I stepped into her life as a young Mormon in Utah and to learn as much as I could about her life. And then Greg Olson and I did A Killing in Amish Country together about a very rare murder among the Amish in 2009. And so, again, learning about the Amish and winning their trust when they don't usually give interviews was really, really important to, you know, usually winning the trust of people is pretty important to these books. And I always, I don't take that for granted.
Absolutely. It's incredible access that you do have. I want to thank you very much and hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Rebecca Morris.
I really
you have a great
it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good night.
Yeah.